For decades, America has tried to combat the harms of drug use primarily through banning drugs and incarcerating people who use them. But this has caused a violent underground market for drugs, increasing crime in our communities. It's caused contaminated substances, increasing overdose deaths, and it's caused incarceration to skyrocket, destabilizing families. What we're doing isn't working. Crime, death, and broken families are the collateral damage of using the criminal justice system to address the public health issue of drugs. If you're looking for a better path forward, you're in the right place. What if we changed our drug policies to prioritize life, health, harm reduction, and thriving? And what if it benefited all of us? Our criminal justice approach to drugs had a beginning, and it can have an end. Join us on the journey to end it for good. I'm Christina Dent, your host, and if you're new here, End It For Good is a nonprofit started in 2019 based in Mississippi that invites people to support approaches to drugs that prioritize life and the opportunity to thrive. This podcast is one of the ways we do that. You can head over to episode 34 to hear my story as a conservative Christian foster mom changing my own mind on the best path forward with drugs, and then come on back and dive in deeper. I didn't change my mind overnight, and most other people don't either. We all need time to learn, think, ask questions, and explore. Whatever your perspective is, I'm glad you're here. Let's journey together. Welcome back to the End It For Good podcast. I'm Christina Dent, your host, and I'm here today with my friend, Christy Barong Barber, whose story is included in my new book, Curious, which you can grab on Amazon. She has become a friend. We met through this work, but I'm just so thankful for her voice and her courage and her vulnerability. And so, Christy, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
So tell us a little bit about yourself. What do we need to know about Christy?
Well, I'm a mom first and foremost, and I'm a mom who realized that being a mother is not as easy as I thought it was going to be. And I guess decided to face those challenges head on. Other than that, I work in healthcare at one of the orthopedic groups, and have done that for about 26 years. Not with this group, but I was at St. Dominic's for a while. That's me.
Awesome. Well, you share a lot in the book. Your story takes up most of one of the chapters, but you share a lot about your walking with your son through an addiction that started in his early teenage years and are continuing to walk with him today through that. So you can tell us whatever you want to kind of backstory wise, but what I want to get to is kind of what are the biggest things that you have learned as you have walked with your son through that journey? Because there are so many families and so many parents who are walking a similar journey with their loved ones.
I think the first thing I learned does go back to the beginning of his story. And the first thing I learned was that pretending that it wasn't real was not doing anything. I had to face the very harsh reality that my son was dealing with something that was potentially deadly. And as a mom, I couldn't fix it. So I think that was the first lesson I had to learn, was that there's no amount of love, even though a mother's love encompasses a lot of things, there's no amount of love that could make my son well again. So I had to face the hard work that had to be put in for that. And along those lines, the lessons that I learned were, I had to rethink what addiction was, because addiction to me was what I had seen on TV. And the realities of it are so different from that. One of the questions I get asked a lot is is addiction a disease or a choice? And there is a point where it it stops being the choice to get high, and it becomes the need not to be sick. And that was a hard thing for me to sort of wrap my head around, to understand that this wasn't something that he wanted to do. It was something that he had to do.
And being sick, you're talking about withdrawal symptoms. Once you've used opioids for a period of time, your body becomes dependent on them. If you stop using,
the entire chemistry of your brain changes over time, and you'll experience pain and nausea and GI issues and so many physical symptoms, and it's agonizing. So it's not about the choice to get high. It's about trying not to be sick. The other thing I learned, I think was my most critical lesson, was that there's no rule book. What works for me isn't going to work for the next person. Mm-hmm. When I started out, I was trying to, quote, follow the rules. I was told that I had to use tough love. I had to cut him off. I had to walk away. Don't answer the phone unless he's agreeing to get help. And I remember very vividly, Mike and I were dating at the time. And I remember telling him that I was a failure. And he was like, well, I haven't known you long, but that just doesn't sound like you. And I said, the one thing they're telling me to do is the one thing I can't do. And so I kind of had to learn that it was okay for me to find my own path. And it was okay for me to make up my rules as I went along, if that's what worked for me and my son.
And what was that path? What was the path you feel like you chose instead?
I chose more to meet him where he is. I sort of live every day by the motto, if my son dies tomorrow, can I live with the decision that I'm making right now? Because the reality is that this thing can take him from me any day. Even now, I could wake up tomorrow and find out that he has drawn his last breath on this earth. And if that happened, could the last thing I said to him be, I'm not going to give you food? I couldn't live with myself. I couldn't do it. If he called me and said, Mom, I want to take a shower, and I said no, that would destroy me. So my motto has become, like I said, if my son dies tomorrow, can I live with the decision that I am making right now? And every time I am faced with a decision, that's what I think through. What is the decision that I can live with? And so if he calls me and says he's hungry, could I live with myself if I sent him money and he bought drugs and overdosed? No, I couldn't. But he can't overdose on pepperoni, so I'll send him a pizza or buy him lunch. And, you know, I get the argument that that's making it easy for him. I don't think that it is.
And what gives you that confidence? I think that is, there's probably a lot of parents who they either fall on kind of one side or the other. You know, they've taken that tough love approach. Or maybe they would say, well, that's what, you know, the firm hand, the being held at arm's length or being cut off completely so that they can hit rock bottom. You know, that's the thing to do. And what has been his response, I guess, to that? Like, what you obviously are continuing this over a number of years, this kind of approach of not getting him way down deep with him in the middle of the chaos, but trying to meet him in the ways that you can, so that, like you said, you can know that you are doing what you can to help him feel loved, to help him feel cared for. What has been his response to that?
His response is different based on whether he has relapsed or is fighting to be in recovery at that time. And it is, I've told him, I'm going to kind of backtrack here. I've told him just here recently, the fact of the matter is you are addicted. This is not going to go away. the choice that you have now becomes whether you die in active addiction or you live in recovery. And so the response from him to this sort of meeting him where he is depends a lot on where he is in his journey. But I have found that as I have been more, I don't want to say open, but as I have been more accepting of this is where we are and this is what I can do. And I'll tell him, okay, so I'm not going to send you money because you're using, and I know you're going to use, but I will make sure you're fed. He has been a lot more open with me. He came home after rehab once and we set rules. We had very strict rules and he followed them. And I got home one day and he told me, he said, Mom, I'm not going to break your rules, but I've got to go. And he had relapsed. And so I told him, I said, well, you can stay and we'll figure it out and we'll get through this. And he insisted on leaving. But the response from him has been that he's much more respectful of my boundaries because he knows that I'll not negotiate the boundaries, but it's not an all or nothing approach. So he's much more apt to say, Mom, I know I'm using and I know I'm in active addiction, but this is what I need. And we can talk that through. So his response to it has been fantastic. And I honestly believe that this approach is the only reason he is still alive. Because he wasn't running from me at every turn. And he allowed me to take a more active role in the day-to-day of his life, the good, the bad, and the ugly. Even when it was horrible, he allowed me to be a part of it.
Hey friends, this podcast is just a part of the work we do at End It For Good, inviting more people to this conversation on changing the way we approach drugs and addiction. We want strong families, safe communities, and policies that uphold the dignity and value of every single human life. If you're not signed up for our monthly newsletter yet, head on over to enditforgood.com, scroll to the bottom of the page, and sign up. You'll get all the info on the rest of the work that we do, including live events, and it'll get you plugged in to the End It For Good movement.
I think that's one of the things that's really inspired me about your story is your just desire, willingness, even in the hard, you're trying to walk that middle ground instead of just saying either you have to completely change or I can't engage at all and I'm going to stay way over here and I'm going to be completely out of your life. Really trying to walk that hard middle line of having a relationship, letting him know he's loved and cared for, while also taking care of yourself, making sure that you can stay healthy and not get wrapped up in all of the things that are going on.
The drama that can be
part of that. And I think that is just really amazing, especially as I hear people's stories of recovery who have found long-term sobriety and how many of them did not have that in their years of active addiction, or if they did, how meaningful it was to them. You know, it might have been a person who was not a significant role in their life, maybe not a parent, maybe it was somebody random, but somebody random who in the middle of their addiction, you know, took that step to help them feel loved and cared for. And I just think that's a big part of maybe what we've missed and what we could reclaim. And I'm always pointing people to the CRAFT training, community reinforcement and family training that people can take. Christy's like figured this out on her own, but there's actual training you can take that teaches you how to stay connected to your loved one and stay healthy and have a relationship in a way that actually helps build that relationship and helps them be more open to getting help when they helping them, you know, recognize that they need help. And so I think that's just really beautiful. So go ahead.
And I would like to add to that one thing to parents who are facing this and starting this journey and trying to figure all of these things out. The one thing you have to remember is that everyone will have an opinion, and someone is going to tell you that what you're doing is wrong, regardless of the path you choose. You have to know your child. You have to know the limitations that you have. People mean well. I'm not going to say that any of it comes from a bad place, because people mean well, but I've told so many parents, every person who is addicted, every path of addiction, every path of recovery, every parent's journey is unique. There are no set in stone rules for any of it. And that can be a very lonely place, but it's okay to say, this part works for me, but this part doesn't. So I'm going to combine those two things, and that's all right. But regardless of what you do, someone is going to tell you that it's the wrong thing to do. And you just have to very graciously accept what they say and understand that it's not coming from a bad place. But I can tell you this, in all of the support groups that I belong to and all of the Facebook moms of children who are addicted and incarcerated, in all of those groups, the one thing that I hear more than anything is the regret of not being there and losing their child, of not picking up the phone when they called and then finding out that they were gone and they'd never have that opportunity again. Those are the regrets that I hear, not the regret of, he asked me if he could come home and take a shower, so we sat down and ate a meal together and then he overdosed. That's not the regret. The regret is I cut him out of my life and I didn't find out until weeks later, had to find out through a stranger. So whatever your path is, there will always be opinions, but you've got to figure out what you can live with.
Yeah, I think that's really helpful. I think in a lot of areas of life, there is, you know, even on this issue, and James Moore's story, who's in my book as well, just his own talking through like the what you can live with, and that when you, so James has lost his son. And so for him, he's in that position of looking back on how they handled that over the years of their son's struggle. And he says, you know, even when you think about the kinds of solutions, like the policy solutions, like we like to talk about, so there's right. kind of solutions within a family, and then there's these bigger picture solutions on, you know, how can we reduce harm? How can we deal with the fentanyl crisis? All of that. You know, he says a lot of the solutions that seem crazy to you today start to look a whole lot better when you really believe that you could lose your child. It's kind of like one set of, if that reality does not sink deeply into you, then you want a particular outcome, and there's maybe some particular things you feel like, you know, are going to be the path you're going to take. But if you really push that to the ledge and say, what if the worst happens? Is this something that I can live with? Is this still the solution I want to support? It's kind of like, it's not really looking at like what's best case scenario. It's kind of what's worst case scenario. And what can I right. live with in that world? Because a lot of the time we don't get best case scenario, and we don't get do-overs necessarily. And so it's a different world where we have such high toxicity drugs on the street and so many people using, and the risk is just so high. And I think that's another piece of why more families are looking for another approach than just cut them off, because there are more parents, like you're talking about, who have lived that horrific loss of their loved one and wish now they could go back and do something different to preserve that relationship for as long as they were able to have it.
I agree.
So shifting gears a little bit, there's kind of this movement in various parts of the country for parents whose children either overdosed, maybe they overdosed and survived, but also parents who lost their children to overdose, who are saying we should increase penalties for, you know, whoever was the last person to touch the drugs before, you know, the person who took them and died. Like, they're often called drug-induced homicide laws, or death by dealer laws, depending on kind of where you are and the terminology that's used. That has not been something that you have taken up. You wrote an article against that, actually, when Mississippi was considering that a couple of years ago. Why is that? Where does that perspective come from? When I think a lot of people could empathize with, you know, hey, if somebody sold your child drugs and they overdosed, then they should be prosecuted for whatever ends up happening.
So I guess the biggest reason that I don't support those laws is because I know how far underground it will push these kids to go. The harsher we are on punishments and the more we look to demonize people who are dealing with substance use disorders, the more they're going to try to hide from society. They're going to try to hide from authorities. They're going to try to hide from their parents. Trust me, I have tried to find mine in some really awkward places. And so again, back to the whole meeting him where he is thing, I realized that he was less likely to hide from me if I was not constantly trying to punish him for things. So the more we put overdose homicide laws into effect and the more we criminalize people who are already dealing with the stigma and the fear and everything that goes along with their drug use, the more we do that, the harder they are going to try to hide. And the more you're going to see those overdose deaths increase because they're not going to call for help. They are not going to reach out. They're not, there are so many ancillary people that are affected by those laws. And I think the reality is that most people believe when one of these so-called overdose homicide laws goes into effect, they believe that that is affecting the people who are trafficking large amounts of drugs. These people are maliciously trying to poison our children. But the reality is the people that those laws affect are just trying to survive like your child is, and they're
often friends, loved ones.
Exactly. Yeah. And people who are using, they are just as wrapped up in this disease process of addiction and substance use disorder. They are just as caught in that disease process as the person that you love. And so I think that there's a misconception about who those laws will help and hurt. Because the fact of the matter is the quote dealers that are typically arrested under those laws are just kids who are using themselves.
Yeah. And it can even be a scenario where I often think these laws are, they're written like for the world that people maybe who aren't using drugs think exists versus like exactly how it actually exists in the real world, which is it would be very common for a group of kids to get together or young adults or adults to get together. And one person goes and buys drugs for everyone, you know, and they, you know, they're not all going to leave the apartment or wherever to go get whatever they want to use. So somebody goes and gets it. You share the cost. Well, that person is now the dealer. I mean, it's the person right who bought the drugs. And so if one of those people overdoses, that's now the person who is considered the dealer. Whereas in reality, that's not what most of us think of when we think dealer. And yet that's the person. It's the last touch, the person who bought the drugs and who, you know, in a way sold them to the rest of the people in the room.
Right.
But it works a lot more like everybody throwing money in for a pizza, in terms of the way that that actually is a little more, bearing out in real life rather than in our minds of kind of how we think about that or how the, media has portrayed what we think of as dealer. We kind of think of this very strict line between dealer and user. And in the real world, that's often not a strict line. On any given day, lots of different people could float between what could be considered a dealer. You know, if they bought more than they needed of something and they sold some to a friend and they used together or something like that. So it's much more complicated. And like you said, it really incentivizes people to, if somebody's overdosing, leave the scene. That's the opposite Absolutely. Of what we want. But how do you know if you're going to be considered the one, you know, who was the last person? How do you know if you're not going to be charged with something? And we want people to have the most possible incentive to call for help immediately, to stay with the person, to do everything they can, not to scare them into, you know, fleeing the scene and not staying to help.
And I had those same misconceptions. I thought that drug dealers were these people wearing masks that, you know, had this factory set up at their house and they had a business model, and it was what I had seen on TV. But the reality is very different. I mean, they're just kids.
If you're listening, you're interested in solutions so that fewer people are harmed by drugs or addiction, hop on our website and grab my new book, Curious, A Foster Mom's Discovery of an Unexpected Solution to Drugs and Addiction. It is a memoir of my learning journey on these issues. It starts when I'm 9 years old and continues through the founding and growth of Endo for Good. But it's really more than a memoir. It includes the stories of people like Michelle, who found a unique path to sobriety, and stories like James, who walked with his son through addiction and has incredible wisdom to share with other families. It's really more of a memoir on a mission to share my journey and the people that I've met along the way with you. There are better solutions. Grab a copy of Curious for yourself and maybe one for a friend. And let's grow a movement toward life, health, and hope. So talk to us about what you have started. You started a Molly Angel Project is the name of it.
Yes.
Tell us about what that is, why you started it, what that means to you.
So again, with the background in healthcare, I realized early on that I had access to resources that a lot of people didn't have. My son had overdosed, and the people that I worked with, the doctors and nurses that I worked with, found out, and that was kind of the moment that you have these moments that you don't realize are so impactful then, but you do later on know just exactly what an aha moment that was. And when I got back to the clinic after going to the hospital, one of the doctors gave me a prescription for Narcan. He said, you know, I don't want you to have to do it, but if you need to help your boy, I want you to be able to.
Because he survived that overdose.
He did survive that overdose. And so I took that prescription and I went to the pharmacy and I told the pharmacist what I needed, and I paid $100 and I got it, and I didn't think twice about it. And then it was days later, I was like, wait a minute, I had the $100 to spend on that, and I had the doctor to give me the prescription for it. It shouldn't be that hard for mothers to be able to prepare to help their children. So the flip side of that coin is that my son passes out my phone number like Tic Tacs to his friends. And so I was getting calls from kids, and I was getting to know this entirely different side of society. And so Molly was Chance's high school sweetheart. Her name was actually Molly Angel Morrison. She died of a fentanyl overdose in November of 2019. And so I told my son that I wanted to make sure people had access to the resources that they need, whether they were in active addiction, whether it was their parents trying to figure out a way to help them. And he asked me to do it in Molly's honor. So I started the Molly Angel Project initially to just make sure that people had Narcan, and
which is the opioid overdose reversal medication.
Yes, that's it's a nasal spray that reverses the effect of an opiate overdose. It doesn't affect any other process of the body. If you find someone unconscious, it is always safe to use. It's not going to affect anything else if there's something else going on with that person. But people were afraid of it because they didn't know those things. So I wanted to change that. And it's kind of taken on a life of its own. I still work to make sure people have access to Narcan. I realized that Mississippi doesn't allow for much in the way of harm reduction. So I started supporting changes like decriminalizing fentanyl testing strips, which was a huge thing. And just sort of being that. I honestly, one of the things that was a surprise to me that happened out of the Molly Angel Project was I became the mom that people could ask questions of for other parents who didn't know where to turn, because there's such a horrible stigma around my child is addicted that no one wants to talk about it. So I kind of inadvertently became the mom that people could talk to, and I was willing to speak up, and I was willing to say, yes, my child is addicted, and this is what I think we need to do to make things better. And so I think in some small way, it's sort of blurring those lines of that stigma and letting people know that it's okay to talk about it, to ask for help, and to try to find ways to deal with it, either physical ways like carrying Narcan, or, you know, knowing that fentanyl testing strips are not an excuse to do drugs. It's just opening the conversation.
And through that, through your work with Molly Angel, you've done a lot of just direct work with people who are in the throes of a substance use disorder. All different parts of town. You're all over the place. You've helped people understand what's happening with wound care and all kinds of other things that they're dealing with, that are part of what happens with prolonged exposure to elements if they don't have a house, all sorts of those things. What are some of the lessons that you have taken away from that?
Oh, where to start? I think the most important lesson that I learned was that that my perception not only isn't always right, but it really doesn't matter very much. What I believe to be true does not matter at all. I learned that. I think one of the biggest lessons was that no one is immune from this. I've seen the kids of professionals. I've seen kids who grew up in the streets because, you know, their parents were addicted. It really doesn't matter. There's no way to predict it. There's no way to avoid it. It affects all of us, whether you want to talk about it or not. I've learned so many lessons. Usually the biggest lesson that I learn is that I'm wrong about stuff all the time. I'm always wrong about something. But I had to learn to adapt to that. I had to learn to realize that what I think is probably not the way it is, and just to adapt quickly and to love people regardless, and that sometimes feeling like I didn't do enough, but just holding somebody's hand was more than they had ever had.
Yeah, that's beautiful. I think it's so much of what I think about now, you know, driving past people who are holding signs about the side of the road. And my youngest son is always interested in sort of like what their story is, you know, why are they there, mom? What's going on with them? And just to be able to see that through, we can have all different opinions about sort of what the ultimate solution for those things are, but just to see the humanity in people, the suffering in what they're going through, what they maybe have been through, for which, you know, if we could see the arc of their life prior, would probably have a lot of compassion for what they've been through and what has gotten them to that point, even if we want a very different solution and want to help them work towards a very different life too.
And I told someone that it was on social media, and someone posted a video of someone using drugs in the Jackson area behind a convenience store. And I was like, you know, I know that to you, that's a video that gets views, but I know her. I know that when I was looking for my son, she came out from behind a dumpster and she helped me find him. I know what brought her to where she is, and I don't know how to help her, but to you, it's views on social media, but to me, that's a person that I know. And I think I wish more than anything that people would realize that people would realize that every one of these kids that you see on social media, that you see on the side of the road, there is an overreaching arc to their life and to their story. And fortunately, a lot of us have not had to go through those same heartaches and hardships. But maybe we could just show a little bit more compassion for those who have and didn't know how to deal with it, didn't have the resources, didn't have the mental stamina to come out on the other side of that and be okay.
So what would you tell a parent who is listening, their child is struggling, they don't know what to do? Like you've said, you don't have the silver bullet. There's no magic solution. But what encouragement would you give to them?
I would say the one thing that I say every time I post on social media, one thing that I say, there is always hope, and it's hard to see it sometimes. It's hard to sit at home and not know where your child is, or to not know what tomorrow's going to bring, but there is hope, and there are people who will show that kindness. And I think the biggest lesson that I want people to learn, and the one thing that I want people to take away from all of this, is to, as hard as it is and as much as it goes against your instinct, love them where they are. Do not miss the opportunity to love your children, even if you have to love them in the hardest parts of their lives, in the ugliest parts, because it's ugly. But don't miss out on that opportunity. And whether or not they seem to realize it, whether or not they appreciate it at the moment, whether or not it seems like it's making any difference at all, it is. My son has several times said, "Mom, do you remember when?" And I'm like, you remember that? I didn't even think you knew who you were that day. And he was like, "Yeah, but I remember looking up and seeing you there."
Beautiful. Thank you so much, Christy, for sharing with us such a vulnerable part of your own life, but I think your perspective is really helpful for other people who are walking through it too, letting them know there are other pathways, and offering some encouragement to them. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, Christina.
All right. Thanks for joining us on the End of for Good podcast. I'm Christina Dent, your host, and we'll see you back for our next episode. So how do we shift our drug policies from a criminal justice approach to a public health approach? By inviting one person at a time to change their mind. Changed minds are the catalyst to changed laws. But many people are only willing to have this conversation when they're invited to by someone that they trust. That's you. Invite your friends, coworkers, other people in your circle of influence to consider a better way. At End It For Good, our hope is that people who hear will become people who tell. Start a conversation and join the movement to end it for good.